NPR Music presents this encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. We'll hear about the life and music of bassist Milt Henton. He passed away in 2000 at the age of 90.
It's a happy way of playing. He could come into this room right now all by himself and the room would just light up.
I always thought of Milt Henton because he inspired me to listen to the bass.
All I can say, there's just not enough accolades for Milton Henton, the judge. He's the greatest. We call Milton the judge, of course. He's such a great timekeeper. When you work with the judge, you're gonna get some time.
His warm, engaging presence has been lighting up bandstands for more than 70 years, from stride to swing to bebop and modern jazz. He's been there with fluid yet steady bass lines that can wrap a tune in velvet and send it sweetly through the air. His instrument, a 250-year-old handmade bass violin, stands just a few inches taller than he does. He's taken it around the world to perform for presidents, kings and queens, with Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, and Cab Calloway. His recordings are treasured by jazz historians, yet he's known and loved simply as the judge. I'm Nancy Wilson on this edition of Jazz Profiles, a salute to the life and music of bassist Milt Henton.
And I'm sure that everybody who knows him and who does love him seem to think that he's always been there.
Trumpeter Clark Terry is right. Milt Henton has been there. For a bass player, like an anchor, keeps a jazz band grounded. And a bass, like a heartbeat, sets the tempo. The judge, for Clark Terry and countless others, is the anchor, the heartbeat, the timekeeper of jazz.
He had a very individual sound, great big booming bass sound. His sound would be like ga-boom, boom, boom, and another bass player, bing, bing, bing. So it's very easily detected when you hear that nice big round fat sound of his.
The steadiness of his beat and his choice of notes as a bass player were always exactly what was needed.
Bassist John Clayton.
As a bass player, you've got to not only be the steady pulse that keeps everybody's foot patting, but you've also got to choose notes that make sense for the soloist to play on top of. And Milt Henton is one of the kings of beautiful, important notes.
He was one of the best bass players that I'd ever heard.
Trumpeter Jonah Jones shared the bandstand with Milt Henton during the 1940s when they worked in Cab Calloway's legendary orchestra.
Oh, yeah, he was a great accompanist. I think he was one of the greatest during that time because he knew how to play them card notes, you know.
His ability to play just the right chords made the judge one of the busiest musicians in New York during the 1950s. You can hear his handiwork on hundreds of albums, those of Barbara Streisand, Sam Cooke, Clark Terry, Percy Faith, Aretha Franklin and Bobby Darin, to name just a few. He's proud of the work, but he doesn't boast about the wonderful opportunities he's had, and he's never needed the spotlight to shine on him.
It's necessary that you have the humility enough to want to make somebody else sound good.
Milt Hinton.
Very few bass players have ever become leaders. It's a subservient job, but we can feel like Alice. I'm holding the band up. The prime requisite of a bass is support. I break it right down to the word bass, and it means bottom. It's musical, it's the lowest musical instrument. Architecturally, it's the lowest part of a building. Mm-hmm. And in order for the building to survive, it must have a strong bass.
The supportive role Milt Hinton insists on playing doesn't prevent his infectious, warm personality from coming through. He's not a large man, but he is a presence. His smile commands the room, and his eyes dance when he plays the bass. He's generous, consistent, and attentive, on and off the bandstand. Bassist Rufus Reed.
That's one of the reasons why he's so loved. The feeling is so incredible. So even though he might be playing something, you know, technically simple, the buoyancy and the way that he plays it, it is infectious.
As a musical technician, Milt Hinton is the man who perfected a style of playing called the slap bass. It's his signature sound. Bassist John Clayton.
He is the king of slap bass. There's just no one that can do what Milt Hinton can do with the bass in the slap style.
And he can do it in such rhythmic control.
Rufus Reed.
Way back then it was, they may have played without having a drummer. And so he would do the walking bass lines with the slapping bass.
Slap Happy, featuring bassist Milt Hinton with Lionel Hampton on vibes and Jimmy Ford on drums. Milt is a skilled improviser who draws from a deep well of blues and jazz rhythms, but he's also one of the few bass players who is classically trained. It's helped him to become one of the most versatile musicians in the business, performing with symphony orchestras, on soundtracks of Broadway shows, television commercials, as well as pop and rhythm and blues hits.
He loved the challenge of playing different kinds of music and never knowing what you were going to play.
Writer and documentary filmmaker David Berger, a former student and now close friend and associate of Milt Hinton's.
When studio work happened for Milt in the early 50s, he really was prepared. He really had the ability to walk into a studio and to play anything that faced him, and he never knew what it might be.
That versatility is a quality Milt Hinton has conveyed to dozens of younger bass players. Again, David Berger.
What I have always seen with Milt, right from the beginning, is a very, very strong sense of passing the tradition on to the next generation.
Milt's roots go back to the Deep South, where he was born, Milton John Hinton, on June 23, 1910, in Vicksburg, Mississippi. It had been less than 50 years since the end of the Civil War, and vivid images of slavery and of the Confederacy shaded his boyhood.
This was about 1917 to 1918. I was 7 or 8 years old. And I noticed this big crowd on the corner. And being an inquisitive kid, I wanted to walk up and see what was going on. And my aunt Sissy was trying to pull me away from it. And when I got close, I saw this congregation of men just standing around a tree. And I looked up at the tree, and this man was hanging up there on the tree. And I just couldn't believe what I saw there, of this man running like a piece of bacon on this tree limb.
In these early years, Milt lived with his grandmother, a former slave. His parents had separated when their only son was just 3 months old. Milt grew up surrounded by a loving, extended family. But as he grew older, he watched his relatives, one by one, pack their bags and head north to Chicago, the Promised Land.
All out for the Panama, train going north, make connection with all points. No, train already. Watch your step, please. Have your ticket. All aboard. This train is bound shy. This train.
All aboard.
This train is bound shy. This train.
All aboard.
This train is bound shy. Get on board if you want to ride this train.
The North beckoned to African Americans with the promise of a better life. In 1910, 45,000 people lived in neighborhoods on the all-black South Side. By 1930, almost 250,000 people had moved there. Milt's mother, Hilda, and a couple of uncles went first. They found jobs in a nice apartment on the South Side. Shortly after that, in 1919, they sent for Milt and his grandmother.
Things were great. Chicago was bursting. The biggest stockyards in the world was there. Black labor was very important. There was also a lot of good, decent housing there.
After spending hours in the slaughterhouses, factories, and railroads, black workers didn't have to go far to unwind. The South Side bustled, with nightclubs, restaurants, dance halls, and theaters on every block. These establishments were managed and staffed by African Americans, and by the 1920s, many were frontmen for organized crime lords like Al Capone. The bootleg liquor was flowing, the parties went on round the clock, and the well-to-do patrons, both black and white, were satisfied. And musicians benefited from the steady work.
It was a great world, and my mother was so inspired. Being a musician herself and an organist at the church, she wanted me to be involved in music. And she would take me to the theater. We had loads of theaters on the South Side. And on Sundays, we had this high-class theater, the Vendome, with this wonderful band conducted by a great musician named Erskine Tate. And this was a fabulous band of black musicians. Louis Armstrong was in this band. The great Eddie South, the great violinist, was in this orchestra. And these men were dressed up in tuxedos and looked so very dignified. And the audience was a complete black audience. And we could sit any place we wanted and look at our own artists perform. It was most inspiring to us.
Back at the Hinton household, music was served up right along with the rich, tasty southern meals Milt's grandmother used to make. His mother, Hilda, rehearsed her church choir at the house, and she had piano students a few days a week. When Milt was 13, she bought him a violin and paid for him to take lessons.
Well, I spent a lot of time practicing because my mother had a short fuse, and she insisted that things be correct. There was nothing short of being right with my mother. And when I came home from school, I had to have a little lunch, and I had to practice and practice until I got it right. Well, I thank her for that now, but in those days, it was pretty tedious for me because I'm trying to practice and look out the window and see the guys playing baseball and all of those kind of games, and I wanted to get out there.
Hilda wanted her son to have every possible opportunity to develop his craft. So she urged Milt to join a children's branch of the National Black Music Association.
when I didn't want to go. And then in the first place, in the black society, we had what they call blue vein society. That is, black people that were light enough for you to see the blood in their veins through their skin. And these people looked at people like me, that 99 and 44% black. They looked at me like I was crazy. They always had better jobs, they were better dressed, and they had better opportunities in those days. And so this Junior Music Association was filled up with their children. Well, I went, and the kids wouldn't even talk to me. And that broke my heart. And I came back home and told her, I'm not going back in there anymore. And she says, I'm sending you there to learn and to be educated in the place of music, and they're giving scholarships, and I think you can qualify. You go back and win that scholarship. And, of course, I went back, and this stood me in great stead to this very day. She was the first one to tell me about not let anything concerning color interfere with your talent and your being placed where you should be.
Milt continued to develop his musical talents at Wendell Phillips High School on the South Side. David Berger.
The Wendell Phillips High School experience for Milt is an extremely important one because he learns a good deal about versatility, playing different kinds of music, and playing different kinds of instruments.
The band teacher at the high school was a military man, a real taskmaster named Major N. Clark Smith. He taught Milt how to play a variety of horns, including the tuba. Eventually, Milt switched to bass. It was a matter of practicality. Always observing what was going on around him, he noticed that as silent movies gave way to talkies, the violinist, who used to accompany the films, weren't getting much work.
And I said, hey, I got to do something better than this. So I said, I better get me a bass violin.
Milt taught himself to play well enough to get hired for a few local gigs, making a lot more than the few dollars he earned from his early morning paper route.
And my mom said to me, look, you got newspapers at 5 o'clock in the morning. You can't come in here at 4 o'clock and then get up and change clothes and go out and deliver newspapers. She said, now you got to do one or the other. And I was afraid to lose that job with my newspapers because that was my lunch money. And I didn't know whether anybody was going to continue calling me on in this music business, and that was the greatest decision of my life, whether to give up my newspaper route and start playing music.
It's NPR's Jazz Profiles, with a tribute to bassist Milt Hinton. I'm Nancy Wilson. In 1931, at age 21, Milt got an offer to join a band led by violinist Eddie South, one of the musicians he'd idolized since he was 10 years old, sitting in the Vendome Theater on Sunday afternoons.
And I got to work in a club on the north side that was owned by Al Capone called Club Rubaiyat, a very fashionable club where we could play with just three or four pieces. It was great just working with him. I enjoyed it. All of the musicians around Chicago, especially the white musicians around Chicago, came over between shows to hear the South because he was such a great performer.
Violinist Eddie South with the young bassist Milt Hinton, who's also singing vocals here.
Old man Harlem gives me Sandy Hattie, and I've got old man Harlem in my bones. You can always find me dancing when the day breaks, but old man Harlem keeps me rolling on. Takes all your dough and keeps you skimping. Makes you old and gray before you're limping. Oh, old man Harlem gives me Sandy Hattie, but that old man Harlem keeps me rolling on.
Milt says he learned valuable lessons about playing with feeling when he worked with Eddie South. It also boosted Milt's reputation in Chicago and in Hollywood,
where South's band performed for 6 months. When Milt got back to Chicago in 1936, drummer Zooty Singleton hired him, but the judge wasn't with him for long. Cab Calloway came to hear them one night and asked his old buddy Zooty if he could steal the bass player. The next morning, Milt boarded a train, headed to Moline, Illinois, for his first gig with the Calloway band.
I was very anxious to get on the bandstand, and I had Al Morgan, the former bass player's uniform. Well, Al Morgan must be about 6'6", and I'm about 5'6". So it was the coat was too large, the pants was too large, the sleeve of the coat hung down through the middle of my palm of my hand, and it had me sitting right up front, right by the piano, because Al Morgan had been a star in this band, so they put me in the same spot that he'd been in. Well, I hadn't got a chance to play, and I asked Cab Calloway where I was in music, and he said, there's no music. Al Morgan didn't need any music. He knew the music. So the piano player, Benny Payne, was very kind. He said, well, kid, the thing is in B-flat. Just listen. And the band struck up in B-flat, and I played with them, and things went down fairly well until Cab says, well, let's give this kid a blood test and see what he knows. Al Morgan had been a star, and they had a number called The Reefer Man. It featured Al Morgan, bass solo.
Milt didn't know how to start his solo, but Benny Payne told him to just play in the key of F.
Well, man, I grabbed F, I squared F, I cubed F, I chromatic'd F. I was playing F, and the band was falling out. The guys were laughing, you know. Cab Calloway was holding his sides, playing. When the band came in, when they came in, I was scared to death. I never heard so much noise in all my life.
You ever met a funny reefer man? Have you ever met a funny reefer man? If he says Wall Street is funny, cause he won't sell the Atlantic, then you know you're talking to that reefer man.
The Cab Calloway Band, swinging with bassist Al Morgan on The Reefer Man. Back in the 30s, there were no amplifiers to add volume to the bass. They had to use a lot of finger strength and pressure to get a sound that would resonate with the rest of the instruments and still keep time. Milt Hinton perfected that technique, which became known as the slap bass style. The judge is the undisputed king. Milt Hinton on Pluckin' the Bass, recorded by the Calloway Band in 1939. Bassist John Clayton explains the slap bass technique.
Rather than sort of slide your finger across the strings, you grab the string and you'd almost throw it toward the audience, let's say. And when a bass player does that, it has a lot of oomph and a lot of percussive power.
Rufus Reed.
You pull the string and then you slap with the palm of your hand on the fingerboard kind of rhythmically together. And there's a snap, slap, You know, and I asked him one day, I said, how do you do this? He says, you have to have a senior citizenship card before I show you how to do this.
Bassist Milt Hinton, showing us how it's done. Few musicians made the transition from the slap style to swing and beyond. But Milt handled it with ease and went on to become one of the most recorded musicians in jazz. That's just ahead. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a salute to the life and music of the judge, Milt Hinton, on NPR, National Public Radio. The Cab Calloway Band, performing Milt Hinton's composition, Ebony Silhouette. Milt stayed with the Calloway Band for 16 years, longer than any other musician. During that time, and in later years too, the judge would usually show up at a date with his bass in one hand and a camera in the other.
He has this sense of what's significant, what needs to be recorded for posterity, what was real history being made.
Writer and music historian Patricia Willard.
So many of us live through history and don't really realize that significant things are happening around us. Milt recognizes that instantly. I think he has from the very beginning.
Over the years, Milt took more than 60,000 photographs of musicians, candid shots from recording dates, live concerts, rehearsals, and life on the road. He took photos of Billie Holiday's last recording session and of a very young Dizzy Gillespie trying to get a little sleep, hunched over in a corner of the Calloway tour bus. His photos of life in the South are especially telling. Trumpeter Clark Terry.
For instance, he's got pictures of groups going into restrooms, one that says colored and one that says white.
Patricia Willard.
There are such pictures as the one from the Atlanta train station with these famous musicians underneath the sign that says colored entrance. Milt didn't just take pictures of the musicians waiting for the train. He got the sign above their heads with one of them looking at it. And it speaks volumes.
Gonna tell you about the jumpin' jive. Jim Jim jump the jumpin' jive. Cat's gonna beat out this mellow jive.
During his stay with the Calloway Band, Milt was always honing his skills and open to new ideas. Writer David Berger.
He wanted to grow as a musician. He didn't like the idea of falling into a pattern, playing the same repetitious Calloway music every night. And the musicians would get together in the basement of the theater, and some of them, not all of them, would organize section rehearsals. There was Chew Berry, the very, very famous tenor saxophone player who died long before his time in a terrible car accident, and Dizzy Gillespie and Mario Bauza were in that band. And these people were interested in new arrangements, and they wanted to play more complicated music.
Trumpeter Jonah Jones remembers how they were inspired after hearing a new saxophone player named Charlie Parker.
And I couldn't hear what he was doing, but Dizzy could hear it. Then, when we went back, he would take Milt Hinton downstairs between shows, tell Milt to play this number, to hit this note, and he would run this fretted fifth and fretted ninth against it. And finally he got sore, with Milt backing him up like that, he could play bebop.
Dizzy Gillespie, along with a young Kansas City saxophonist named Charlie Parker, went on to become one of the pioneers of a new music that extended the boundaries of jazz with its innovative harmonic and rhythmic concepts. They call that music bebop. By the late 1940s, Milt was living in New York City with his wife Mona and daughter Charlotte, since the Calloway Band played the Cotton Club for 6 months out of the year. Bookings were on the decline, though, and because Milt had spent so much time on the road, he didn't have too many contacts in the city and got very few jobs. From time to time, he worked with Count Basie in clubs around Manhattan. He was happy to be at home with his family and refused offers to go on the road until a request came from a musician he'd idolized for years, Louis Armstrong.
I remember Louis from Chicago when I was a kid growing up and delivering newspapers, and I'd go by rehearsals and listen to him jam and listen to the guys play. And by 1953, leaving Basie's band to join him was a great asset for me. But this was his first trip to Japan. From the time we got off the plane, it was just fantastic. People were applauding, and it looks like he just rises to a very special occasion in his playing. I found on the stage at the Kokusai Kikyo Theater that he was playing, so it was so exciting, I forgot to play. I was standing there, I was listening to myself. I said, oops, I'm supposed to be playing, and I'm not. It was just a great engagement to listen to him play in a country where he hadn't been before. He seemed to just overdo it. It was just so wonderful.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Velma Middleton, Billy Kyle, Summer Young, Kenny Jones, Bonnie Vigard, Milton, myself, we want to let you know that we enjoyed swinging, and you're a very fine audience. And I'd like for you to get together with Louis Armstrong and his all-stars and wish the whole world a happy new year.
Louis Armstrong and his all-stars recorded live in Yokohama, Japan on New Year's Eve in 1953. It's NPR's Jazz Profiles with a tribute to bassist Milt Hinton. I'm Nancy Wilson. After the Armstrong tour, Milt had a few short stints around New York. One night, he bumped into his old friend, Jackie Gleason, whom he'd met when they worked small clubs in New Jersey. Back then, Gleason conducted a series of albums called Music for Lovers Only. He invited Milt to sit in on a recording session with the full orchestra.
So the next day I show up at Capitol Studios, and I'm pretty nervous because I'd never played since high school with that many string players. There's 65 men there. The only black there beside me was Bex Powell, our drummer. Music is an auditory art. People will really respect you by how you sound. As we begin to play, I've got my good bass with me and my griffilla, and then all of the other string players begin to come over and recognize that I had this good bass, and it was sounding good, and that I could play it. And some contractors were there, and they heard me play, and they asked for my name, and it was then that I began to get some work.
David Berger.
So Milt, by 1954, 1955, is working with 200 or 300 musicians playing in New York City. He was doing a variety of steady radio and television weekly shows, but most of his bread and butter came from the freelance work in the studios.
By the mid-50s, on any day of the week, Milt might record with a symphony orchestra in the morning, a small jazz ensemble in the late afternoon, and jam with a rock and roll band long after midnight. He was one of the busiest musicians in New York. His work is featured on Broadway soundtracks, albums by Johnny Mathis, Sam Cooke, Sarah Vaughan, and bandleader and producer Quincy Jones.
trumpeter Clark Terry.
During that period, there weren't an awful lot of black musicians who were used in the studios. And Milt opened the doors not just because of his ability to play and his quality of musicianship, but his manliness. He was a real gentleman, a real man. He carried himself in a fashion that you had to love him. Even if you wanted to hate him, you couldn't.
The judge did his best work during this period with pianist Hank Jones and drummer O.C. Johnson, a powerhouse trio that came to be known as the New York Rhythm Section. Again, Clark Terry.
Whenever you walked on a date and you saw the three of them, you said, uh-oh, somebody's going to get some time. They could play anything at any tempo in any part of the world with anybody, for anybody. The three of them were at the top of the heap as far as the professionalism on their instruments was concerned.
And that truth can be heard on this 1965 recording of the Duke Ellington composition, Ring Them Bells, with Lionel Hampton on vibes, Ben Webster on tenor sax, and Clark Terry on trumpet, and the New York Rhythm Section of Hinton, Jones, and Johnson.
Good time train is leaving, ring them bells. Ain't no time for grieving, ring them bells. Got my round trip ticket, ready to yell. Oh, mister, ring them bells. Mr. Jones, ring them bells. Oh, boy, the music swells. Yes, I like it. Lift up my head and yell. Oh, Mr. Jones, ring them bells. Ring them bells, Mr. Ben, the Big Ben.
Singer Bobby Darin struck gold when the New York Rhythm Section added their magic touch to his recording of Mac the Knife.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight.
David Berger explains why Milt Hinton and the New York Rhythm Section was so effective.
Arrangers recognized that you could sketch out pretty simple arrangements, have these guys in, and they would work it out for you. Someplace in the midst of Mack and the Knife, there's a key change and it keeps going up. That was an improvised head arrangement. Nobody had planned for it.
Now on the sidewalk, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life.
Bobby said, guys, why don't you just, what do you think you want to do with it? Why don't you all play with that a little bit? Hank Jones says, okay. Hank Jones said, let's go up a half tone after each chorus or tone, whatever it was. And we did that, and it was a smash hit record. I mean, it sold a million sellers. We got 4125. But behind that, the people know, get these guys because they really do the best they can for you.
Do I want you?
The New York Rhythm Section with the Ray Ellis Orchestra backing vocalist Billie Holiday on one of her last recordings in March 1959. By the late 1950s, Milt Hinton's schedule was so heavily booked that he rarely left New York. He continued to freelance until the recording industry shifted its focus to Motown and Nashville. After that, he sat in with talk show host Dick Cavett's house band on ABC television, and he concentrated on jazz dates, working regularly with old friends pianist Hank Jones and drummer O.C. Johnson. When he wasn't on the road, he helped young bassists launch their careers. John Clayton.
Every session I've had with Milt Hinton has been special, and he is the kind of person that is always anxious to share. Milt Hinton will give, including money. He has supported so many young bass players financially and helped to get them going.
Brian Torf.
Milt really is someone who has had one of the biggest impacts on my life. And I'm not just the only one. I mean, I think you could probably, you know, find dozens of other young players whom he's helped. He sent them on their way. He gave them their start. But it's more than just he gave us a job. He gave us a kind of idea that said, this is my heritage and now it's your heritage, and I'm trusting you to do the right thing with it.
Stops. You'll find the sun laughing at life. No road is lonely if you
Milt Hinton, the judge, laughing at life. And what a life he's lived. He's traveled the world, shared the stage with legendary entertainers, and been honored by heads of state. Milt Hinton has been in the unique position of both participant and observer at important moments in the evolution of jazz. It's a legacy that lives on in the thousands of photographs he's taken, in his books, Bassline and Overtime, in the hours of oral histories he's collected, and in the stories he shares with his students. As an artist, he's continued to be versatile, always growing and developing his technique. Milt Hinton has been the foundation, or what the judge likes to call the basement, for some of the greatest jazz musicians of the century.
Not in my wildest dreams did I ever dream that these kind of things would happen to me. It's like we're talking about the humility of wanting to be a bass player, and wanting to support, which is what it is, but to receive the rewards from this, it's really just mind-boggling. I'm the bass player, that's just the bass player, and I'm so grateful for that, really. Judge, I can't remember names, whether bi or trifocals, my vision's still the same. I tote my bass and vocals, I don't play piccolo. If my pressure is high or low, I still hear the stereo. My fragile bones can easily break, but all they do is ache and ache. Well, now I've got less hair, bills died in Medicare, but I'm still laughing at life. Yeah.
Our tribute to Milt Hinton was written and produced by Njamili Carol Jones, post-production engineer Saraya Muhammad. The interviews with Milt Hinton originally appeared in the series Basslines, produced by Fred Landerell, in collaboration with David G. Berger and WRTI-FM in Philadelphia. Other interview segments were conducted by Dr. Billy Taylor for the Smithsonian Institution's Jazz Oral History Program. Special thanks to David Berger, Allegro Records, Chiaroscuro Records, and NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. Senior editor, Robert Rand. Our website coordinator is Patrick Breslin. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, visit NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've been listening to an encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. Bassist Milt Hinton passed away in 2000 at the age of 90. Discover more great jazz at NPR Music with our series Live at the Village Vanguard. Live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.